Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. So my name is John Peters Coleman. This week we'll be talking to David Ravijohn, and he's going to tell us about AfriFest, which is coming up soon, a celebration of African and Caribbean culture and heritage in Bristol, which you should look out for on the 30th of September and the 1st of October. I'll also be speaking to Stephen Loft-Simpson, who is a European sedan chair specialist. Our roving reporter speaks to Dr. David Hamilton about the contagious power of thinking and how feelings can be contagious. Tony Gosling brings us part 8 of the Bristol Aero Collection and is once again in conversation with Oliver Dearden. Mike Noyce next week will be speaking to a musical artiste called Jacques et Robin. That is his title, I'm told, and as a precursor to that, we'll be playing one of his tracks later on called Butterfly on the Wall. As usual, we have another episode of Treasure Island, read expertly by Malcolm Grieve, and some poetry coming from Tim Burrows later on, and of course the What's On Guide, written but not read by Jeff, unfortunately, he's away this week, but nevertheless, there will be a What's On Guide. Coming up soon, we have Bristol's AfriFest, and here to discuss it with me is David Ravijohn. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for asking. Nobody ever asked me how I feel. But no, it's not about me. No, tell me, what is AfriFest?
Well, first and foremost, let me introduce myself. My name is David Ravijohn. I am wearing two caps. I'm the executive director of PAX Productions, which is a multicultural and performing arts organization. And I'm also the program coordinator for AfriFest.
Okay.
AfriFest is organized by African Voices Forum in collaboration with African and Caribbean Organization and Malcolm X. Okay. This is the second year of AfriFest. It's a festival of arts, cultural heritage, and achievements.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about what prompted AfriFest to be started. We already have quite a vibrant sort of African-Jamaican festival in the St. Paul's Carnival. Also, to a lesser extent, the Islamic Cultural Fair sort of could cover some African culture. So what's AfriFest
really
about?
Well, of course, you just made mention about the carnival. It's a carnival.
Yeah.
Slightly different. I was also the chairman for the St. Paul's Carnival 6 years ago. It's bigger. The AfriFest is more focused on African culture, African and Caribbean culture, their heritage. And this year, we have added achievement, talking of Community Champions Award, which we want to recognize achievement of black people, what they have contributed in terms of invention, writing books, etc., etc. So that's why this festival came about. Looking at the background of AVF, that is African Voices Forum, it's an umbrella organization that was established in 2008 to provide support to African and African Caribbean communities. It's also there to encourage positive role modeling for BME young people. So that's prompted bringing AfriFest together, let people come together, diverse culture, show their different culture, their dance, their food, their music, their attire. We'll be also having beauty contest crowning of AfriFest queen and king. We also have fashion show from the different countries portraying cultural shows. Different countries are doing 5 to 10 minutes. We also are involving the schools. So it's cut across.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about how you think the African community in Bristol has developed. I mean, for people who might not know very much about African communities that have been in Bristol. I mean, how long have there been African communities?
Oh my
here?
God, it's a big community, the African community, or African and Caribbean community.
Yeah.
You have different, you have the Nigerian Association, the Ghanaian Association, Kenyan, Tanzania, Sierra Leonean, Bangladesh, the different Caribbean groups from either Tobago or Jamaica or the St. Lucia. You have all those different Caribbean groups. Of course, these different organizations do their own different program,
okay,
but the role of AVF is to bring all those different organizations.
Okay, so before AfriFest, did you feel that perhaps all of these different organizations didn't get together enough in between all of these various different...
Not very much, because it was a little bit independent. So that's the role. That's why AVF is in there, to bridge those gaps. That's why the theme this year also is linking communities, bridging the gap. And what we have also done, last year it was a one-day festival. Mm-hmm. This year is a 2 day festival.
Okay,
on the 30th of September, it will be at West Pierpont-Trim Methodist Church. That's why we use the word, the theme, linking communities.
Yeah.
And then, of course, on the 1st of October, which is the start of the Black History Month, we'll be having it at Malcolm X Center, which is 141 City Road, St. Paul's.
Okay. So what can people expect to be able to take from it? If there's a celebration of African literature, will there be stalls selling books and that sort of thing? So
books,
yeah.
Food.
Yeah.
We'll be having, among the program that we'll be having, is we'll also be having cuisine from different countries around the world. A cuisine competition. Yeah. Want to see different African food? Come. I'll tell you, I promise you. In fact, you will have you will be my special guest to see. Because last year it was fantastic, and this year I want to make it more bigger, involving more organizations. So it will be different food, different attires, different styles, different traditional games, because we also have program for the children activity, okay. Traditional games. This is something that's why we say bridging the gap. A lot of children who are from African or Caribbean descent are born here. They don't know much about their roots, their background. So that's why we want to be that mentor to educate them.
Tell me a little bit about what opportunities African Jamaican communities have to express themselves through the local media. I mean, there is Ujima.
Oh, yes.
For example, I mean...
Yes, of course, Ujima is one big medium. I'm also a presenter at Ujima. Yeah. Every Saturday morning, it's called Back to Your Roots. My program focuses on all arts and cultural events. It also looks into all the different ethnic groups, their cultural and traditional beliefs, ritual, music, dance, food, ceremonies.
Do you think people forget, perhaps, that there is probably as wide a difference between different African communities as there is between, say, people from different European countries or countries from people from completely different countries in the world? I mean, African community sounds like one homogenous block, but of course there'll be a huge different variety of
people. There is a lot of variety, but not very well. It's just like dialects. In my dialect, I am from Sierra Leone, originally from Sierra Leone. I'm from the Creole tribe. One word in Creole means another word in another dialect in Sierra Leone, different. Because for my country, we have 18 dialects, right? The Mende, Timini, Limba, Creole, English. If I say go away, the Mende man will interpret it as go by. If I say wait for me, the Mende man will interpret it as I'm not a white man. That's what it means.
Right, okay.
If we say I'm not a white man, I say wait for me. If I say wait for you in Creole, the Mende man will say don't call me white man, I'm a black man.
Right, okay. So you're hoping that people will be able to take from this what a large diversity of different peoples are all going to come
absolutely
under this umbrella of?
Oh, yes.
Okay. If people want to find out more about AfriFest in the meantime, how can they...
Yes, of course. I mean, AfriFest, as you can see, the office for the African Voices Forum is based at Malcolm X, 141 City Road, St. Paul's, Bristol, and the postcode is BS2 8YH, and you can contact us. You can email avf@yahoo.co.uk.
Okay.
But also you can contact us on 0777-965-4257.
Okay, so just a reminder, on Friday the 30th of September, it's going on at Westbury on Trim, and that's in the Methodist Church Hall, 46 Westbury Hill. And on the 1st of October, which is the Saturday, it's going on at the Malcolm X Centre, which, as he says, is on City Road in St. Paul's. And on the leaflet, just to recap, live performances, Bouncy Castle, very important, food from Africa and the Caribbean, various workshops, a fashion show, children's workshops, games, stalls, cooking, demonstrations, folk music groups, a whole lot of stuff going on. So, David Ravijohn, thank you very much for coming in and chatting to us about it.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. David Hamilton is an expert on how our thoughts and minds can physically change our bodies. His latest book, The Contagious Power of Thinking, presents scientific evidence that emotions can travel and that 25% of our happiness is due to the happiness of our friends. Dialect's Anthea Page met him at a recent lecture, and this is what he had to say about those subjects.
I'm with David Hamilton at the Birrin Centre in Portland Square, Bristol. Tell me about your lecture this evening.
It's called The Contagious Power of Thinking. So basically what I'm going into is how emotions actually are contagious. You know, like people notice that they feel happy around happy people and you feel sad around sad people. And I'm explaining why that is, and even how you can, by understanding that, you can actually stop catching people's emotions and even project your own. So like if you happen to be soaking up stress or anxiety from people, then you can learn how to not do that and actually build your own positive emotion and project it. And what I'm covering is the way this occurs is we have this little group of cells in the brain, and they're called mirror neurons, and they allow our brains to copy the physical muscular movements of people. But because our muscular movements are so tied in with the emotional circuitry of the brain, what you get is not only do we find ourselves mirroring people's gestures, but we actually catch the emotion. So that's really how it occurs.
Why did you get into this? Are you a sad person or are you happy?
I would say I'm a generally happy person, very much a positive person. I actually got into this because the book I've written on, it's my fifth book. The last book I wrote was all about kindness, and being an ex-scientist, I was researching the scientific evidence for the benefits of kindness in the body. And I came across a lot of research that shows actually how contagious kindness is. And my hope, and really all of the lectures that I give and the books that I write, is that people can take some of the information I present in some way and try to make the world a better place. And that's why I was writing about kindness. And I came across this stuff on contagious kindness. Now, it wasn't relevant for my last book. It didn't really fit. So I thought, I'll park it until I'm finished the book, and then I'll start on this new one. So I did, and then I started really researching the whole subject of contagious kindness, and that naturally led me into how it works in the brain. And when you understand how it works in the brain, you start to see that happiness is contagious and depression is contagious, stress is contagious, even things like obesity are contagious, you know, divorcing is contagious, smoking cessation, alcohol behaviour is contagious. We tend to copy people. We don't even realise we're doing it, but we do it anyway.
Well, we are sociable beings. We can't avoid people, can we?
No, definitely not. We are so sociable. You know, this, I'm glad you said that, because this capacity in us is actually genetically wired because we are social beings, because this capacity to mirror in the brain is what allows us to understand each other. It's actually, it plays a big part in the way that we learn from each other, because not only do we learn from the words that people say, but we learn from the emotional content of the words. You know, the way that people make subtle gestures with their face and with their hands, that's actually part of what we absorb. So if we didn't have that capacity, words would just be black and white to us and we wouldn't really understand. So it actually helps with us learning. So it's a genetically wired capacity.
You said genetic. Don't you think children learn from their parents about kindness and being positive in a way?
Absolutely, yeah. But we have this genetically wired component. I think it's compounded. I guess people talk about this whole nature-nurture debate. People say, oh, it's totally nature, and people say it's totally nurture. I would say it's a bit of both, really. And we have this natural genetic predisposition, but we can overwrite that positively or negatively but through upbringing.
What about the media? Don't you think the media has a large part to play in making people depressed?
Without doubt, yeah. In fact, there's a couple of pieces of research that shows if, let's say you're talking about children there, if children, for example, are exposed to too much negative media, it can have an effect on their behaviour. So, for example, exposing a child, a teenager even, to too much violent media can actually suppress their natural tendency to feel compassion and their natural tendency to show kindness to someone in need.
Because actually the news, you know, you said talk about violent news, it doesn't actually teach us about other countries and other people. It just tells us something that we can't do anything about.
And it emotionally arouses us as well. You know, we get emotionally aroused by the stuff, that negative stuff, and it almost becomes addictive. And that's, you know, you find people switch on the news to hear about the next bout of negativity, even though you don't want to hear it, because actually it emotionally arouses people. What would be better if the media were actually putting in a lot more of inspirational stuff, positive, because there's so many positive, inspirational things going on in the world, you just don't hear about them because we're fed all this negative stuff.
Do you think radio has less of an impact?
If you were just talking about negativity, if the same stuff was presented in radio and TV, then radio would have less of an impact, because there is more emotional data there if you can hear it and see it at the same time. But if you can only hear it, then there is less data, so to speak. But radio plays a big part, because, I mean, I listen to the radio every time I'm in the car. In fact, the moment I get in the car, I've just driven an hour and three quarters to get here, and I had the radio on the entire time, and I love listening to people talking. As daft as it might sound, one of my favourite bits of the radio is when people start talking in between songs. And some people say, I hate that bit, just put on the music, but actually I love it. It feels like, just listen to people talking about stuff, I feel like I'm there with them. So I love that part of radio, because you just don't get that on TV. And that's what I particularly love. And I think that boosts me. It's like, especially in the morning when you hear people playing off each other in the morning, joking and laughing and stuff, and that just elevates me. Sometimes for a 2-hour drive, I'm feeling fantastic because I'm just listening to these people bantering in the morning. I love it.
So tell us more about your books that you've written.
It's like a whole running theme about the way in which how you think and feel has an impact on your life. And the way I started out was exploring the impact on your health. I mean, I used to be a a scientist in the pharmaceutical industry. Traditionally, I used to help to build cardiovascular and cancer drugs, meaning you stick atoms together to construct a chemical compound which gets mixed with other ingredients to become a medicine. And I became fascinated with the placebo effect. You know, like so many people get the drug, so many people get a placebo. And you find that a lot of people who get placebo get better. So I started to, in my own time, while I was a scientist in the industry, to research the mechanism of the placebo effect. Why is it that believing and thinking something can have such a health-giving effect? And so eventually I resigned from the industry because I thought I want to dive into this entire field. So I resigned and started researching independently and writing books on that series. And, you know, so my first two or three books were all about that. And then the last few have been exploring like kindness and compassion, even when you hold that in your mind, or whether you physically show an act of kindness or compassion, the impact on your heart, for example, your nervous system, the beneficial effects of kindness and compassion. And that, as I say, naturally took me into how it's contagious and how really acts of kindness can ripple right through a social network.
What help and advice do you think your lecture will give to people this evening?
To understand that they matter. I think a lot of people, especially where I was brought up in Scotland, a lot of people feel small and insignificant. And when you understand this stuff, you realise that you're always projecting. You're contagious. We think of contagious being a negative thing. You catch an illness, a virus or bacteria, but actually our behaviour is contagious. Our emotions and attitudes are contagious. So when you understand that, you actually have more of an impact on the world than you think. So you can start to do these little random acts of kindness, which really do have a ripple effect. You just don't always see it. Even a smile is contagious, because a person, even though people don't always smile back, they secretly do. They just don't know that they do, because it's a reflex reaction and your brain can't overrule the little flick. You've got these muscles called zygomaticus major that control your smiling, and they tweak within 25 one-thousandths of a second if someone smiles at you. Even if you don't smile back, you really do. You just don't know that you're smiling. So a smile is never wasted.
Do you think happy people generally get on better in life?
I guess it depends how you look at it. There is a piece of research that looked at photographs, yearbook photographs of people, you know, like 25, 30 years ago. They found a group of people who had what you call a D smile. Now, a D smile is where you don't just smile with your mouth, but you smile with your eyes, right? And you flex. Basically, there's two groups of muscles that you use. And when they looked at these photographs of D smiles, and basically all of the photographs of people, and then they looked at how much they earned in their life. They just used earning as a marker, as an indicator of success. It's only one of a number of ways you can measure success, but that's the way they chose to do it anyway. And what they found is the people with the D smile earned significantly more money over the next 25 miles than people who weren't smiling genuinely. So the way they interpreted that is these people with the D smile were genuinely happy at the time, and that happiness predicted the success later in life. So success didn't make them happy. It was the happiness that made them successful, which is totally runs counter to what most people think, that you seek success in the world so that you can be happy, but actually it works partly the other way around.
David, what's your website?
It's drdavidhamilton.com.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, thank you.
Thank you very much to Anthony Page and also to Dr. David Hamilton at the Peer Inn Centre. So as advertised at the top of the show, I have Stephen Loft-Simpson here to chat about sedan chairs. Hello.
Good day.
Good day. What, for the uninitiated or the vague of memory, is a sedan chair?
A sedan chair is an enclosed chair with glass windows and upholstered. And they came in London around 1634, 1635.
Okay.
And they brought them in to reduce the traffic congestion. And they're carried by two chairmen, one in the fore and one behind. And they were dressed in green.
Okay. When were the last sedan chairs in commercial use in London then?
The last time that they were mentioned with respect to, if you wanted to, for instance, travel to William IV's tea party,
yeah,
it was 1836.
Okay. How did you become interested in sedan chairs? How have you become so fascinated in them?
It originally started out, I was interested in transport. I used to do a lot of cycling. I used to work for a motor manufacturer, and I was looking into possibly buying an ordinary, or what most people call a penny farthing.
Yeah.
I then decided that was perhaps a bit dangerous if you fell off it.
Yes.
And that I went to an auction just south of here in Somerset, and there was a sedan chair there for sale. And I thought perhaps I might buy that. It would look good in the entrance hall. And it went for too high a price. So I was working in London the following year, and I saw the same chair.
Yeah.
For asking price had gone up, of course. at a leading auctioneer, but I managed to secure it for £1,000 less than they paid in Somerset for it.
Okay, and when was that? How long ago was that?
That was 1998.
Right, okay. So why do you think sedan chairs is worthy of so much of your time and interest? You know, you're certainly a European expert in it. You are too modest to suggest perhaps that you're a world expert in sedan chairs, but how many, you know, experts are there?
There aren't that many. I've helped people with their PhDs, and I was helping an undergraduate in Sicily last year, someone with a PhD in France.
Yeah.
And I looked at it from the point of view that I bought a sedan chair, I was told it was English, and it was by GH. I looked around the various sedan chairs, which can be found in Bristol.
Yeah.
There's one in the M shed. There used to be one in the Georgian house. There are a couple in Bath.
So it's purely by chance of coming across them that you've become so interested in them?
Yes, but also it was my godmother who came to one of my parties, and she walked down the hall and then said, gosh, I used to go to school in one of those. So she was very keen on me continuing the research and taking things further.
Okay. How many have you got at the moment?
I have five, one collapsible and one carrying chair.
Okay. Why do you think they're particularly significant in terms of transport above, you know, other forms of transport? Is it partly because not many people actually specialise in them and you think that knowledge could sort of get lost?
I thought at the time I was looking, and this was 2000, that it was an important time from a historical point of view to start looking at them, because one, the internet was widening, which produced pictures of sedan chairs. Secondly, the transport costs reduced, and the number of chairs in the original areas were going far further afield. I mean, the wealthy Americans had bought them over the last century. The previous century, a lot of wealthy English people bought them from France and Italy.
Okay. Were they very popular at the time that they were available or commercially usable, or was it fairly a minority sort of thing? You know, people with a bit of money to spare might have them. I mean, were they as common as, say, taxi cabs?
They weren't so common in Bristol. There were only two taxi ranks, one in Queen Square and one on College Green in 1757, and they're not listed in future.
Okay.
Right. So they weren't so popular in Bristol.
Yeah.
But in places like Bath, there were 200. There were tens of them in the 1850s. With respect to how many survive of the taxis, the sort of fare you were talking about is £5 minimum fare. It was sixpence, okay, which equates to about £5 now. So the sedan chair was always more expensive for a longer distance than it was to go in a carriage or in a coach.
Surely, I mean, I'm trying to think, you know, what it's like to actually travel in one. Is it the guy who's at the front carrying it has to be aware of what the guy at the back is doing? You have to be sort of synchronised, but presumably you've got the large block of the sedan in the way. How do they coordinate when they're travelling around?
That is very difficult, and I can certainly remember carrying Fiona Bruce around. She was very easy, but we used a body double the previous day, and the gentleman at the back who worked for the BBC was out of sync. You have to be in sync with moving with your feet, otherwise you're forever lifting the chair up an inch and dropping it an inch, and that's rather like carrying a £70
and probably not terribly
sack and having someone lift it off your shoulders and drop it back on, doing that constantly.
I see. So I mean, you can't be terribly comfortable for the person in the sedan chair either if it's constantly okay. Well, I mean, for anybody interested in what we've been chatting about so far, we will be returning to this topic next week, so we will be coming back to this. So for the meantime, Stephen Loss Simpson for this week, take care. We will chat again next week.
Thank you very much.
Our trusty engineer Michael Noyce has recently been inviting musicians round to his house for a chat and to do a live recording of one of their tracks. On the sofa next week will be a Bristol artist named Jacques, a Robin. As a preview, we will play a track from his new self-produced album called Statuettes, and this track is called Butterfly on the Wall.
She plays the butterfly on the wall, and when the dance begins and all the flowers twist their stalks, she's still like a wallpaper pattern, but in her heart wings have started the winds all around to let the air begin. from the shores of Portugal and we breathe into our balloons and let them fly over the sea. They saw them over Brazil, Nazca, and back over Spain. They found us in the streets of Lisbon, then we breathed again. Here I am, here I am, it's me, here it's me. Here, birds, it birds in the sky, how can I send my love in a lullaby? Dawn and funny looks and silence on the stage. She puts her hand into his hand and with her usual grace says, if butterflies from the old world may cause storms in Brazil, why can't we think a change in our heart may change history? Here I am. Here I am, it's me, here it's me. Here, birds, it birds in the sky, how can I send my love in a lullaby? Here I am, here I am, it's me, here it's me. My love in a lullaby.
That was Butterfly on the Wall by Jacques, a Robin. If you liked what you heard, you can see him perform at the Louisiana, which is at Bathurst Terrace, on the 29th of September, or you can buy his album by going to jacquesarobin.com. I'll spell that out for you. www.jacquesarobin.com. Bristol's historic Filton Airfield is set to close to make way for housing at the end of 2012. So, Dialect has been looking back at Bristol's role in aviation history. Now more for our very own aircraft museum, the Bristol Aero Collection, based an hour or so's drive away at the Kemble Airfield in Gloucestershire. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to the collection's chairman, Oliver Dearden, about the famous plane that Oliver himself worked on as a young man.
After the Paris crash, British Airways invested quite a lot of money in their Concorde. They were redesigned inside, and eventually they came back into service. But Air France and British Airways, between them, had to pay for all the backup costs. That was the deal with the governments when they took the aircraft. Whilst an aircraft's in service, there's always a team back at the manufacturers working on it, dealing with faults and modifications as things go on. Now, British Airways and Air France had to pay for all that between them, on the engines and the aircraft. After 9/11, first of all, Concorde lost a large percentage of its passengers because they all worked in the World Trade Center. France did not support the United States in the Gulf War, etc. The Americans stopped flying Air France, and Air France started to lose money on Concorde. Their Concordes were nowhere near as profitable as British Airways. The regular routes was London, New York. They also flew Barbados once a week in the season. Secondly, the aircraft was also getting old, although in hours it's not. It had been flying for 25 years, and spares were becoming a bit of a problem. Now, British Airways had 7 aircraft. They only refurbished 5 when it came back into service. They used the other 2 for spares. But eventually, Air France decided that they were going to stop flying Concorde. Now, for British Airways to carry on flying, they'd have had to have borne all the backup costs, and they couldn't. plus the fact that spares were becoming rather more difficult and harder to obtain. So in the end, unfortunately, in 2003, as you remember, Air France just stopped flying almost the next week. British Airways continued for another 6 months, but there was no commercial way they could keep it flying, unfortunately. So, sadly, it came out of service.
Do you think there's any chance we'll be seeing it in service again? Or?
No. There's no way. Once it was withdrawn from service, it would never fly again. People compare it, say, to the Vulcan, which was put back in the sky. But the Vulcan, compared to Concorde, is a Model T Ford. It was a very simple aeroplane. This is an extremely complex aeroplane, and there's just no way that you'd get it back into the air again. It will cost hundreds of millions.
Now, what about the Concorde that's actually up at Filton? Because it seems to be languishing out in a field as if no one really cares about it.
Well, we ran the tours around it until October. It's been there for 7 years. So Airbus, in conjunction with British Airways, decided it must have some maintenance done on it. So it was closed to the public, and for the past 3 months now, they've been working on it, albeit outside. They've been taking all the inspection panels off, removing bits. They've removed all the leading edges from the wings. Concorde doesn't rust because it's not made of steel, but it does, aluminium does corrode, so it has to be treated. It's not going to collapse. But to maintain it in good condition, it really did need a few months of really good maintenance work done on it, and that's what they're doing at the moment.
But surely if it had been kept in a hangar, it wouldn't need all that looking after.
Fortunately, isn't a hangar available.
We'll have to see if we can find one.
Well, that's what we've been trying to do for the past 7 years, unfortunately.
We're in a hangar here up at Kemble. I mean, this must be one of the nearest, I suppose, to Bristol, and you're still looking.
Yeah, well, you couldn't get Concorde in this hangar. It's too tall.
Right. What about yourself? What was your involvement in the industry? Because I know you worked at BAC.
Only for about 4 years in the 50s. No, I left the aircraft industry then, but always maintained an interest in aircraft. My wife and I did, and when we retired, she joined the helicopter museum, I followed her, and then we joined the aero collection, and here we are.
So can you give us an idea of what was going on when you were working in the business? Because it really was, many people would see it as a sort of heyday of British aviation in those days.
Oh, it was. If you went to the Farnborough air shows of the 50s, every year you went, there was a new aircraft. The excitement, albeit, unfortunately, one or two crashes, but you don't go to Farnborough these days and hear supersonic bangs, do you? You did in the 50s.
I suppose the thing is, if you're going to be at the cutting edge of aviation, there's bound to be a few crashes.
Well, yes. I mean, yeah, unfortunately, by the very nature of aeroplanes, sometimes you take a step too far. There's a problem. It's nobody's fault. They didn't know it existed. A prime example of that is the Comet crashes. The Comet went into service, the world's first pure jet passenger transport, hugely successful. Two mysterious crashes. Nobody knew why for a long time until they found out this problem of fatigue, which they never knew anything about. Like all aircraft in those days, Comets had square windows and they got fatigue cracks at the corner and they failed. And the aircraft just fell apart.
A little crack would sort of actually start opening up whilst the plane was going along.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was something that was what, due to...
It's just the cycle of loading. As an aircraft flies, it's pressurised, it flies, it's flexed, it's moving. So any mechanical structure has got stresses in it which are going up and down all the time.
Well, it might sound a bit worrying, but of course your wing, as you're flying along, is actually bouncing up and down.
Yes, it is indeed. So you've got to be, that's why they test it. And it's fatigue is only like a rubber band. What happens if you keep stretching a rubber band? It breaks, effectively.
Does it?
Yes. Because it's fatigued.
Well, I haven't tried that for a while.
But that's all understood now, so it's not likely to happen. But then something else happens that nobody's thought of. Fortunately, the technology and the testing is so critical today, it very rarely happens. And, I mean, Concorde, as I say, apart from the crash at Paris, which wasn't really the fault of the aircraft, it was just a sort of series of events, has been a very safe aircraft.
Thank you very much to our very own Tony Gosling, and he was talking to the chairman of the Bristol Aero Collection, Oliver Dearden. Our serialisation of the swashbuckling classic Treasure Island continues with Chapter 21, read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 4, The Stockade. Chapter 21, The Attack. As soon as Silver disappeared, the captain, who had been closely watching him, turned towards the interior of the house and found not a man of us at his post but Grey. It was the first time we had ever seen him angry. "Waters!" he roared. And then, as we all slunk back to our places, "Grey," he said, "I'll put your name in the log. You've stood by your duty like a seaman. Mr. Trelawney, I'm surprised at you, sir." "Doctor, I thought you had worn the king's coat. If that was how you served at Fontenoy, sir, you'd have been better in your berth." The doctor's watch were all back at their loopholes. The rest were busy loading the spare muskets, and every one with a red face, you may be certain, and a flea in his ear, as the saying is. The captain looked on for a while in silence. Then he spoke. "My lads," said he, "I've given Silver a broadside. I pitched it in red hot on purpose. And before the hour's out, as he said, we shall be boarded. We're outnumbered, I needn't tell you that. But we fight in shelter. And a minute ago, I should have said we fought with discipline. I've no manner of doubt that we can drub them, if you choose." Then he went the rounds and saw, as he said, that all was clear. On the two short sides of the house, east and west, there were only two loopholes. On the south side, where the porch was, two again. And on the north side, five. There was a round score of muskets for the seven of us. The fire would have been built into four piles, tables you might say, one about the middle of each side, and on each of these tables some ammunition and four loaded muskets were laid ready to the hand of the defenders. In the middle the cutlasses lay ranged. "Toss out the fire," said the captain. "The chill is past and we mustn't have smoke in our eyes." The iron fire basket was carried bodily out by Mr. Trelawney, and the embers smothered among sand. "Hawkins hasn't had his breakfast. Hawkins, help yourself and back to your post to eat it," continued Captain Smollett. "Lively now, my lad. You'll want it before you've done. Hunter, serve out a round of brandy to all hands." And while this was going on, the captain completed in his own mind the plan of the defence. "Doctor, you will take the door," he resumed. "See, and don't expose yourself. Keep within and fire through the porch. Hunter, take the east side there. Joyce, you stand by the west, my man. Mr. Trelawney, you are the best shot. You and Grey will take this long north side with the five loopholes. It's there the danger is. If they can get up to it and fire in upon us through our own ports, things would begin to look dirty. Hawkins, neither you nor I are much account at the shooting. We'll stand by to load and bear a hand." As the captain had said, the chill was past. As soon as the sun had climbed above our girdle of trees, it fell with all its force upon the clearing and drank up the vapours at a draught. Soon the sand was baking and the resin melting in the logs of the blockhouse. Jackets and coats were flung aside, shirts thrown open at the neck and rolled up to the shoulders. And we stood there, each at his post, in a fever of heat and anxiety. An hour passed away. "Hang them," said the captain. "This is as dull as the doldrums. Grey, whistle for a wind." And just at that moment came the first news of the attack. "If you please, sir," said Joyce, "if I see anyone, am I to fire?" "I told you so," cried the captain. "Thank you, sir," returned Joyce, with the same quiet civility. Nothing followed for a time, but the remark had set us all on the alert, straining ears and eyes. The musketeers with their pieces balanced in their hands, the captain out in the middle of the blockhouse, with his mouth very tight, and a frown upon his face. So some seconds passed, till suddenly Joyce whipped up his musket and fired. The report had scarcely died away ere it was repeated and repeated from without in a scattering volley, shot behind shot, like a string of geese, from every side of the enclosure. Several bullets struck the log house, but not one entered, and as the smoke cleared away and vanished, the stockade and the woods around it looked as quiet and empty as before. Not a bow waved. Not the gleam of a musket barrel betrayed the presence of our foes. "Did you hit your man?" asked the captain. "No, sir," replied Joyce. "I believe not, sir."
"Next best thing to tell the truth," muttered Captain Smollett. "Load his gun, Hawkins."
"How many should you say there were on your side, Doctor?"
"I know precisely," said Dr. Livesey. "Three shots were fired on this side. I saw the three flashes. Two close together, one farther to the west."
"Three," repeated the captain.
"And how many on yours, Mr. Trelawney?"
But this was not so easily answered. There had come many from the north, seven by the squire's computation, eight or nine according to Grey. From the east and west, only a single shot had been fired. It was plain, therefore, that the attack would be developed from the north, and that on the other three sides we were only to be annoyed by a show of hostilities. But Captain Smollett made no change in his arrangements. If the mutineers succeeded in crossing the stockade, he argued, they would take possession of any unprotected loophole and shoot us down like rats in our own stronghold. Nor had we much time left to us for thought. Suddenly, with a loud huzzah, a little cloud of pirates leapt from the woods on the north side and ran straight on the stockade. At the same moment, the fire was once more opened from the woods, and a rifle ball sang through the doorway and knocked the doctor's musket into bits. The boarders swarmed over the fence like monkeys. Squire and Grey fired again and yet again. Three men fell, one forwards into the enclosure, two back on the outside. But of these, one was evidently more frightened than hurt, for he was on his feet again in a crack and instantly disappeared among the trees. Two had bit the dust. One had fled. Four had made good their footing inside our defences. While from the shelter of the woods, seven or eight men, each evidently supplied with several muskets, kept up a hot, though useless, fire on the log house. The four who had boarded made straight before them for the building, shouting as they ran, and the men among the trees shouted back to encourage them. Several shots were fired, but such was the hurry of the marksmen that not one appears to have taken effect. In a moment the four pirates had swarmed up the mound and were upon us. The head of Job Anderson, the boatswain, appeared in the middle loophole. "At 'em, all hands! All hands!" he roared in a voice of thunder. At the same moment another pirate grasped Hunter's musket by the muzzle, wrenched it from his hands, plucked it through the loophole, and with one stunning blow laid the poor fellow senseless on the floor. Meanwhile a third, running unharmed all round the house, appeared suddenly in the doorway and fell with his cutlass upon the doctor. Our position was utterly reversed. A moment since we were firing under cover at an exposed enemy. Now it was we who were uncovered and could not return a blow. The log house was full of smoke, to which we owed our comparative safety. Cries and confusion, the flashes and reports of pistol shots, and one loud groan rang in my ears. "Out, lads, out, and fight him in the open! Cutlasses!" cried the captain. I snatched a cutlass from the pile, and someone, at the same time snatching another, gave me a cut across the knuckles, which I hardly felt. I dashed out of the door into the clear sunlight. Someone was close behind, I knew not whom. Right in front, the doctor was pursuing his assailant down the hill, and just as my eyes fell upon him, beat down his guard and sent him sprawling on his back with a great slash across the face. "Round the house, lads! Round the house!" cried the captain, and even in the hurly-burly I perceived a change in his voice. Mechanically I obeyed, turned eastwards, and with my cutlass raised ran round the corner of the house. Next moment I was face to face with Anderson. He roared aloud, and his hanger went up above his head, flashing in the sunlight. I had not time to be afraid, but as the blow still hung impending, leaped in a trice to one side, and missing my foot in the soft sand, rolled headlong down the slope. When I had first sallied from the door, the other mutineers had been already swarming up the palisade to make an end of us. One man in a red nightcap with his cutlass in his mouth had even got upon the top and thrown a leg across. Well, so short had been the interval that when I found my feet again, all was in the same posture. The fellow with the red nightcap still halfway over, another still just showing his head above the top of the stockade. And yet, in this breath of time, The fight was over, and the victory was ours. Grey, following close behind me, had cut down the big boatsman ere he had time to recover from his lost blow. Another had been shot at a loophole in the very act of firing into the house, and now lay in agony, the pistol still smoking in his hand. A third, as I had seen, the doctor had disposed of at a blow. Of the four who had scaled the palisade, only one remained unaccounted for, and he, having left his cutlass on the field, was now clambering out again with the fear of death upon him. "Fire from the house!" cried the doctor. "And you lads, back into cover!" But his words were unheeded. No shot was fired, and the last boarder made good his escape and disappeared with the rest into the wood. In 3 seconds, nothing remained of the attacking party but the five who had fallen, four on the inside and the one on the outside of the palisade. The doctor and Grey and I ran full speed for shelter. The survivors would soon be back where they had left their muskets, and at any moment the fire might recommence. The house was by this time somewhat cleared of smoke, and we saw at a glance the price we had paid for victory. Hunter lay beside his loophole stunned, Joyce by his, shot through the head, never to move again, while right in the centre the squire was supporting the captain, one as pale as the other. "The captain's wounded," said Mr. Trelawney. "Have they run?" asked Mr. Smollett. "All that could, you may be bound," returned the doctor. "But there's five of them will never run again." "Five!" cried the captain. "Come, that's better. Five against three leaves us 4-9. That's better odds than we had at starting. We were 7-19 then. I thought we were. And that's as bad to bear."
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve, Stuart Addis Swindon, reading Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. Well, it's time to hand over to Tim Burrows. Not a poem, as I said at the top of the show, stand corrected. It's time for a song, and it's a song that's dedicated to the miners at Gleeson.
It's down in the hole you go. Deep dark underground, to raise the shillings and the pounds, to keep the family home. It's no bright sunshine for a miner's son. School is done, take your pit boots underground. The coal's a shiny black treasure that keeps homes warm and bright, fought for by poor miners who sweat both day and night. Dusty deep, as the rescue party rushes in for the waves put them to sleep. The coal's a shiny black treasure that keeps homes warm and bright, fought for by poor miners who sweat both day and night. It's down in the hole you'll go, deep dark underground, to raise the shilling and the pound, family home.
Thank you very much to Tim Burrows, and we'll have more of him in further weeks. We have a What Song Guide, courtesy of Jeff Sparks, who unfortunately is not here in person. He's canoeing up the Zambezi. So to take us through it is Michaela Dennis, in his absence, to read his script.
Hello, this is your What Song Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 30th of September, Angelic Upstarts will be performing with support from Subgenerates, A-Heads and also Hater UK at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. On Saturday the 1st of October, the Rolling Clones, who are the ultimate tribute to the Rolling Stones, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £8.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. On to Song of the Week now, and I present the McCoys. This group formed in 1962, and in their career released four albums before splitting up in 1969. This song, Hang On Sloopy, was one of their best known songs and reached number one in America in the Billboard Hot 100 in 1965. Was the McCoys there with Hang On Sloopy. For more information, check out www.classicbands.com/McCoys. Staying with Saturday the 1st of October, Black Flames will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Doors open at 7:30pm. Finally, on Sunday the 2nd of October, Rick Payne and the Blues Cowboys will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and the gig starts at 4pm. Okay. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to Michaela Dennis, and thank you very much to Jeff for running the script, and hopefully he'll be back next week. Coming up very soon, for those of you who are interested in art trails around the city, the season is not yet over. There is but one more. Arts on the Hill, which is covering Windmill Hill and Victoria Park areas. The Art on the Hill Arts Trail is taking place on the 1st and 2nd of October from 12pm till 6pm. In case you don't know what that is, basically people open up their homes. They are artists or photographers, or they engage in some sort of artistic endeavour, and you can see their art that they do in their own homes and possibly buy some as well. So visit artonthehill.org.uk for more information and just generally about Bristol Art Trails. You can also visit bristolarttrails.co.uk as well. That's all from Dialect for this week. Our time is up. Thank you very much to our studio guests, who were David Ravijohn and Stephen Loft-Simpson, the sedan chair expert. Our features were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. We had another episode of Treasure Island, courtesy of Malcolm Grieve, straight out of Swindon. Tim Burrows treated us to a song, and Jeff Sparks wrote the What's On Guide, which was expertly read by Michaela Dennis. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. If you would like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. That's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman, and have a nice week. Goodbye.
When the planes blacked out the sun and the submarines emerged from the dark water side, everyone ran to the hills to see for the last time what the world looked like when it was dying. And our house was the last to fall. We'd seen all the other families walking past our street, with a flux of children murdered past some bruised feet. Dust of unknown roads settled on their faces. One morning I saw you there, and I called you from a window behind the oak. You were walking steady and older. Did you hear your name? My father stopped, my brother cried, but we all had to do the same. By the time we left our ruins, the day was glowing and the light bathed the oak leaves. Like in the morning, you held my hand to guide me through your dreams. Let's run to the church and pretend it's our ship. Cathedrals in the sun, but will future days be like ponds reflecting? Cathedrals in the rain, cathedrals in the sun, will future days be like ponds reflecting? Cathedrals in the rain, cathedrals in the sun, will future days be like ponds reflecting? Cathedrals in the sun.